Welcome to the Dr. Nyman Show podcast. Today is Sunday, December 13th, 2020. There was some fairly big news today in the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic that Dr. Nyman would like to go over and some more stuff. Dr. Nyman.
Thanks, Ryan. Yeah, I thought today would be a good day to kind of go over the vaccine, mainly because it actually went out the door today out of the Pfizer plant up near Kalamazoo, Michigan. They had live coverage on it, although I think they cut when the truck initially pulled out of the dock. I probably want to keep the driver's secret, and there were federal officers there to for safety and escort services. But basically, you still got an idea. You got to see the trucks in the dock, and you actually got to see the caravan. And there were big 18-wheelers. This was, I think it's Portage, Michigan. It's a smaller city near Kalamazoo. It's where the vaccine was manufactured by Pfizer. And there was coverage inside basically showing the vaccines being packaged and put in dry ice. Essentially, what's being shipped are, they kind of look like actually almost a pizza box. Pizza box has got, I believe it's 925 vials. It's just a little under 1,000. Each vial has five shots in it, so there's almost 5,000 courses in one of the pizza boxes, and then the larger boxes that we're actually getting packaged would have up to five of these. So it has just under 5,000 doses per box with enough dry ice to last, I believe, a week. So they were packaged up, and basically I got a week to either get them into a minus 70 freezer, which in this case it would have been set a little lower than that. It recommended that it's stored at minus 80 degrees centigrade, which is about minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. It sounds like a really cold temperature and really exotic, but most research labs and most large hospitals actually do have minus 70 storage, so it's just a matter of having space in the freezer for the vaccine. It's not that they've got to get new freezers. Of course, if they're full, they would have to get new freezers. But, they would typically have the freezers. Basically, the freezers are set to go down to that temperature. You just dial it in. So, essentially, if you got the freezer and you got electricity, you're good to go. In reality, they typically have backups, make sure that if there's a power failure, that they'll have some type of auxiliary power so that, that the cold chain will be maintained and everything in the freezer won't thaw. Of course, they don't inject frozen vaccine. They actually do thaw it. And once it's thawed, it can be stored in the refrigerator. And I believe that for 5 days. So if you thaw out a tray or part of a tray, take vials out of the tray and put those in the refrigerator to thaw. Once they're thawed, you've got 5 days to get it into patients' arms. So in theory, this could go to more places than just to have the freezers if they've already got the patients lined up. And, they could basically leave it in the box that arrives in. And, it's good in that for a week. And theoretically, if you can get dry ice, you could add dry ice and essentially maintain it in the box that it arrived in. That's not recommended if you're going to do long-term storage. You'd want to have a freezer and you'd want to pack it and put it in the freezer and have easier access and not be unwrapping a box and then wrap it back up again. And I don't know if there are shortages of dry ice or not. But in any event, it was somewhat reassuring, and some of the commentators actually had tears in their eyes because the virus was actually going out, that I think about 500,000 doses went out today. I may be off, and it might be 500,000 are going out in the next 3 days. But I believe the numbers add 500,000. For those who think 500,000 sounds like a low number, it definitely is. The original estimate was that Pfizer would ship 20 million doses this month. And it looks like that is not going to happen. The last I heard was that they were expecting to ship something like 6.2 million, I think. And the reason for the lower shipment was said to be a shortage of materials. It's my understanding that the shortage is actually due to one of the ingredients called proteinase K. This is a very common reagent that's used during the extraction of samples. The samples are extracted for PCR tests, and I believe for the production of the vaccine, the virus is grown up and then the RNA is extracted from the virus that actually goes into the expression system that gets loaded into the liposome. So essentially, the RNA is a component of the vaccine. Both Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are messenger RNA based, so they both need to do this extraction procedure. And if they really can't get the amounts of proteinase K that they thought they were going to get so that they could produce the 20 million doses, and that is what the original expectation was that both Moderna and Pfizer would each produce, have 20 million doses of the vaccine. And in fact, that was really the big selling point of the Warp Speed program. I mean, the Warp Speed program, what made it stand out wasn't that it invented the vaccine, that didn't give the scientists tips on how to make the vaccine. They didn't say, oh, we've got all the ingredients. It was just to provide money. In the case of Pfizer, the money wasn't even to make the vaccine. Pfizer made the vaccine on its own dime, but accepted the Warp Speed money, which was to buy X number. And I believe in Pfizer's case, the original agreement was to buy 100 million doses. And that would be regardless of whether it was FDA approved or not. So the concept behind the Warp Speed promise to buy the product, regardless of approval, was to take the risk out of manufacturing the vaccine ahead of time. That normally pharmaceutical companies know that there's a lot of reasons a vaccine that looks good on paper or even looks good in vitro or in animals or even in a phase one trial may not do as well in a phase three trial and may not get approved. And so they would normally not make the vaccine until they had approval, or at least they had a very high level of confidence that they would get an approval. So they wouldn't get going on the vaccine until they actually saw that A, the larger number of people in a phase three trial were being, it had efficacy in this case that those getting the placebo would have a higher incident or significantly higher incident of COVID when compared to those that got the vaccine. The FDA had kind of telegraphed that they were expecting a minimum of 50%. So if the vaccine did better than 50% and there weren't a significant number of adverse effects, you know, at that point, the company could get going on the vaccine. But in this particular case, just as an example, it's a double-blind study, which is what all of these are. And that means the researchers and the patients don't really know who got what. And therefore, they aren't really going to know that it's working until they unblind it. And the study was set up that once 100 people, for Pfizer, I believe 44,000 were actually given either the placebo or the vaccine. I believe it was split 50-50. So 22,000 got placebo, 22,000 got the vaccine. And then once they had 100 patients that tested positive for the virus, then they unblinded those 100 to see how many of them got the vaccine and how many got the placebo to see if it was efficacious. And when they did that, they were pleasantly surprised to see that the number was in, for Pfizer, I believe it was initially 90%. For the first 94 patients, and then they did a follow-up with another 100, and they actually got that number up to 95%, which was virtually identical to the initial results that Moderna got. Theirs was 94.5%. And both of them were using a very similar approach. They both had targeted the messenger RNA that encoded the spike protein that was sequenced in the original isolate that was made public on January 8th. So January 8th, anybody with an internet connection could find out what the full sequence of the virus was, all 30,000 physicians and all 4,300 or something like that, positions of the spike protein. So they would have the exact sequence of that protein, and they could make the RNA, they could, in theory, even take a relative and make changes in that and come up with the matching sequence. And in any event, that really signaled the beginning of the vaccine effort for COVID-19, when that sequence was released by China on January 8, 2020. And so the reality is, if you can, you know, look at a calendar and you basically need more than two hands to count up the 11 months. It was less than a year, but it was just barely less than a year. And, you know, there's a lot of, this is a miraculous result, and that it takes 4 to 5 years to do a vaccine. Well, I mean, in reality, people started working on a SARS coronavirus vaccine right after the SARS outbreak in China, which was 17 years ago. So 17 years ago, efforts started looking at what the virus was, what the sequence was, what kind of variations there were, what was this natural host. They ended up identifying two other coronaviruses that actually do infect humans that weren't known prior to SARS in China. At that time, there were only two. There was 299E and I think it's OTS or something. I haven't looked at this in a while, maybe 24. But in any event, there were two different viruses that were known before SARS, both of them just produced, they were essentially cold viruses. They produced mild symptoms. People didn't have lasting immunity. They could get infected again. The virus does recombine. It does change. And I think it's OC, 043, I think was the date. But whatever it was, there were two. And then there were efforts to identify the natural host of SARS-CoV, which caused the outbreak 17 years ago. And that led to the discovery of a lot of different coronaviruses in bats, including those that were in the same class as the one that caused the outbreak in China. It was an epidemic. It wasn't a pandemic. About 7,700 people total were infected, and something like 700 people died. And the 770 were lab confirmed. I shouldn't say were infected. They had to meet the case definition. And since SARS stands for severe acute respiratory syndrome, the case definition included the fact that the patient developed pneumonia. So the patient had to have clinical evidence of pneumonia, had to be positive for the virus, and had some of these other respiratory symptoms that were associated with the virus. And that the case fatality rate using that case definition was around 10%. It actually was a bit higher than that initially. It did have a strong age component, just like SARS-CoV-2 does, that most of the patients that died were older patients. Very few patients that died were younger patients. But the older patients, I mean, there were people that were dying that were in their 40s, and not as many as 40s as 50s and 60s. And normally people, you know, if they got a cold virus, they didn't die, period. And they certainly weren't dying yet at rates that were above 10%. 10% was the final number, and that includes all these younger people that had a very low fatality rate. So the fatality rate was significantly higher than 10% for those that were 60, 70, 80 years old and got infected with the virus. And just like the current outbreak, there were various underlying conditions that were associated with poor outbreak outcomes. But in any event, there were similarities between the SARS virus 17 years ago and this one. People did start vaccine research on that virus. And then there was another related virus called MERS, which is Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, which was found in Saudi Arabia. It's the same novel beta coronavirus subgroup. It's very similar to the SARS and the SARS-CoV-2. It's also 30,000 base pairs. It's the size of the genome, and it encodes similar proteins and similar mechanisms, and it's closer to the SARS than it is to these two cold viruses that used to exist, as well as the two new ones. There were two new ones that were discovered. One was discovered in the Netherlands, and that's NL63. One was discovered in Hong Kong, and that's HKU for Hong Kong University, number one. And those two viruses were identified as a result of research that was initiated because of the early SARS outbreak, the SARS-1, which was in began in late 2002. It was first isolated and sequenced in early 2003, in like March of 2003. And there was one version that was at the Metropole Hotel that had a 29 nucleotide deletion in the open reading frame number 8, and that did spread from this hotel to Montreal, Singapore, and Hanoi, as well as Hong Kong. And though that's where most of the initial cases outside of Guangdong province were identified, and they all really came from this one person who was a physician who had been treating patients in Guangdong province who came to Hong Kong for a wedding and checked into the Metropole Hotel. But in any event, the point is that the vaccine that was shipped today from Pfizer was a vaccine that really started as a SARS vaccine project that evolved out of the outbreak in China 17 years ago. And it was further spurred on by MERS outbreaks, which were mostly local in Saudi Arabia and other adjacent countries. That's why the ME and MERS stands for Middle East. They actually looked for it in bats and found it in bats, and they looked in caves and the Middle East and Europe, and they found a similar assortment as was found in China, except the European Middle East variants were slightly different, and kind of formed their own groups. They were distinct from the ones in Asia, but they were still the same general species of virus with the different groupings. And so some of the groups that were working on MERS or were working on coronaviruses were some of the first ones to start making a vaccine. Interestingly enough, the vaccine at Pfizer really began with a couple scientists from Turkey who ended up emigrating to Germany, and they formed a company there. They did a couple of companies, but the one that's relevant for this is called BioNTech, B-I-O, and then a capital N, and then Tech. And that was the company that started the vaccine work with an mRNA platform, and then they subsequently joined forces with Pfizer, and Pfizer had the money and resources to expand this project. And similarly, another small company called Moderna also started using a messenger RNA, and they benefited more from the Warp Speed project in the U.S. The U.S. did provide funding for them to make the vaccine. So in that case, the funding helped make the vaccine. But, you know, as indicated by events last week and this week, it was Pfizer that actually got FDA approval before Moderna. It's expected that Moderna will present data, or the Moderna data has already been filed. And so the Moderna data will be analyzed by the same scientists that analyzed the Pfizer data. They'll be meeting on Thursday and taking a vote. It's widely expected that, like Pfizer, there'll be overwhelmingly positive recommendation. And then the FDA will likely take a day or so, as they did this time. It was approved late Friday night for Pfizer. It's reasonable to assume that next Friday night, the FDA will approve the Moderna version. The U.S. is contracted to initially get 100 million doses, and in both cases it takes two doses per person, so each are supposed to provide 100 million doses for 50 million patients. They were both supposed to supply 20 million this month. And they're both going to come up short. I haven't really heard how short Moderna is going to be, but if they have a shortage similar to Pfizer, it would not be a surprise, in part because They're both messenger RNAs, and they both need protease K, which is in limited supply. And one of the reasons, probably one of the big reasons, this is in limited supply is because the pandemic is out of control in the United States. We lead the world in cases. We lead the world in death. We probably lead the world in hospitalizations, current hospitalizations. And as a result of having so many patients that are infected with the virus, there's a fair amount of testing that's done in the U.S., and this testing is having an effect on the proteinase K supplies available worldwide, and it's creating this problem. So the warp speed was designed to have, you know, vaccine ready quickly as soon as it was approved. And unfortunately, the vaccine that is going to be ready as soon as it's approved is going to be significantly less than was anticipated or promised. It's a little bit confusing on additional vaccines coming to the U.S. from the mRNA platform. Pfizer did offer the U.S. another bite at the apple to increase their order, and I think they asked them multiple times, including recently, and the U.S. passed on that, and so the Pfizer began selling its product to other companies, and the approval on Friday was actually the fifth approval for the Pfizer vaccine. That it had already been approved in the UK, Bahrain, Canada, and Saudi Arabia. So this Operation Warp Speed didn't necessarily make that much virus for the U.S., and in fact, other countries got, vaccine for the U.S., and in fact, other companies actually got the vaccine before the U.S. did, but not by much. I mean, I think U.K. is the first to actually put it in patients' arms, and they did that just a few days ago, and they did it last week, and I believe patients will start getting their shots tomorrow in the U.S. So the virus shipped out, it'll be arriving. There'll be more shipments today and I guess tomorrow and probably the next day. And it'll be arriving at hospitals, and CVS and Walgreens are involved in distributing the vaccine to long-term care facilities. And they'll all be receiving their vaccines Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And at that point, I believe there'll be 500,000. And then how that's going to be distributed is still a little bit unclear. There was talk before the shortages that the locations would actually vaccinate as many people as they had vaccine doses. So if they got 10,000 doses, they would actually vaccinate 10,000 people, anticipating that they would get another 10,000 doses within 3 weeks so that they would have the second shot on hand. Because the shortages, it's not entirely clear that that's going to happen in all or even any of the recipients, that some may opt to take their hypothetical thousand doses and only vaccinate 500 so that they will ensure that they have the second shot for each of the 500 that they start, regardless of how quickly the sample arrives. You know, those two scenarios should produce equal results after 2 months, because one will give 500 now and 500 a month from now whenever they get their next shipment. And at the end of those 2 months, they will have vaccinated 1,000 And the other methodology is if they only get another 1,000, then they'll end up in the same place. I'll give that new 1,000 to the 1,000 that got the first dose. And they'll end up also having 1,000 people vaccinated with two doses after, you know, a month and a half, 2 months, whenever they get the second shipment. Now, if they get a lot more in the second shipment, then those that vaccinate everybody with the first batch would be ahead of the game, because they would not only be able to give the second shot to all of those that they started, but they would have more vaccine to start another round. The other method would also have more vaccine if more was shipped. So essentially after a month and a half, 2 months, both approaches would yield the same result, assuming that there is a second shipment. If there's only one shipment, then obviously the one that only vaccinated 500 will only end up with 500, but the other group would have 1,000 vaccinated once and no follow-up for the second shot, which would not be a good situation. So in any event, that's kind of where the vaccine situation is. The two leading candidates are the two messenger RNAs. I believe that Johnson & Johnson, which has an adeno-based product, adeno-virus-based, is going to be submitting emergency use authorization soon. I'm not sure if it's this month or the beginning of next month. I think there's still some issues with the AstraZeneca trial. There was the issue with some getting a lower dose initially, which gave them a better result. And so they have to figure out, A, whether that better result is real or is just an anomaly that was present because the numbers that got this accidental protocol is relatively small in numbers. And unfortunately, I think if it turns out to be real, that they probably can't get approval for the low dose followed by high dose until they essentially enroll more patients that get the lower dose followed by the higher dose. And so there's going to be a delay in actually getting more data using that protocol, because the first set of data with that protocol was essentially an accident. And I guess there are more people that have been vaccinated. So, yeah, they may be able to get better data just by unblinding more that had this protocol and get their numbers up. And so, you know, it's really not clear what the FDA or other agencies in other countries are going to require for approval if they're on this other protocol, which has fewer patients initially, but they might just have to take a little longer or more to get unblinded. In any event, there's also some issues with the recombinant vaccines. And there'll be problems with, in those cases, they have to recruit. They're just starting the trials or getting ready to start the trials. And as more vaccines actually get approved, then it's harder to get volunteers for new trials, because most of these trials are set up 50-50. So if you enroll in the trial, you have 50%, you'll get a placebo. And it kind of depends upon what your risk factor are. Some people, if you're a healthcare worker, you'll be getting the real vaccine shortly, and some will be getting it tomorrow, and therefore you might not want to. Well, if you do get vaccinated, you're probably not going to be eligible for these other trials, because they obviously don't want people that are already vaccinated when they're trying out a new drug. So you wouldn't be eligible for that. So those that actually do get vaccinated aren't eligible, but those that aren't vaccinated but are scheduled to be vaccinated shortly may be reluctant to enter a new trial because they would rather be certain they got a vaccine. And so far, the best results are also from the two mRNAs. The two different doses may have got to 90%. The original protocol of equal doses was only at around 62%. And there was an average of 70%, which I think included the 90% group, which, again, may or may not be real. So that's kind of where the vaccines are. Briefly, the number of Americans that are dying each day, at least during the week, is now at 3,000. It did hit 3,000 on Wednesday, and it hit it again on Thursday, and then Friday it kind of looked like it did, but there was a problem with some double counting up in Washington State, and so at least my numbers fell just below that. I had 2,950. So it was 50 shy of 3,000 deaths on Friday. I got 3,036 on Thursday, and I had, I think it was almost the same number on Wednesday. So the last 3 days was about 3,000. Media reports were kind of highlighting how dramatic that result was, that they essentially were showing that other catastrophes in the United States had, there were very few that had those types of numbers. Sorry, number one was the Galveston flood, which had 8,000. And then came the Battle of Antietam with 3,675, and then the Battle of Gettysburg with 31,055. And then came the two days I just mentioned, Wednesday and Thursday, that both had over 3,100, according to at least just tallies. Tallies are off by a little bit. Then came the San Francisco earthquake at 3,000. 9/11 was 2,977, and then there were three earlier dates in December that had between 2,600 and 2,800, and then the attack on Pearl Harbor had 2,403. So I had mentioned this earlier, but just briefly repeat, since there have been 3 days this last week that either had a 3,000, over 3,000, or just under 3,000, it's pretty clear that next week there will probably be at least three, if not 4 days, that are again above 3,000 and could actually get up to 3,500. As a reminder, the deaths are a trailing indicator. These deaths that are being reported are not from the Thanksgiving travel or Thanksgiving events that the people that are dying now, entered the hospital, 1 to 2 months ago. The deaths that are reported by the states are not, even real time deaths that they have to basically get confirmation and coroner reports or death certificates. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I know that it trails. I know that the numbers are always lower for deaths in reports on Sunday and Monday. That doesn't mean that the number of people dying in hospitals goes down on Saturday and Sunday, or goes down on Sunday and Monday, whatever. Those represent from the different states. That's what they report, but that's because whoever does these death reports, not as many work on the weekends, and so they don't get recorded and updated, and therefore the reports they receive on a daily basis go down on those 2 days. And it's like clockwork that the numbers reported for the tallies for Sunday and Monday are about half of what they are during the week, and the numbers go down a little bit on Saturday because not all of the states report on the weekend. And so the bottom line, though, is that these 3,000 deaths are not people that got sick a week or two ago. They didn't get sick at Thanksgiving. They didn't get sick going to Thanksgiving. They were sick long before that. They were in the hospital over Thanksgiving already. Some may have been on ventilators by Thanksgiving. And some may have died on Thanksgiving. And they're just now being reported. So these numbers are trailing numbers, and that's the reason I expect these deaths per day to continue going up. That's why 3,500 a day would not be a surprise. 4,000 a day by the end of the year would not be a surprise. 5,000 a day in January and or February would not be a surprise. And therefore, these major deadly events for the United States by the end of this month, there may be either 8 or 9 of the top 10 will be COVID deaths in mid to late December. And then in all likelihood, those that did get infected going to Thanksgiving or at a Thanksgiving dinner, the end of this month probably will be dying and will be recorded as deaths. And therefore they may contribute to the daily totals by the end of the month. And they'll probably contribute to the daily totals in January. And by the end of January, they'll probably have deaths from people that travel over the Christmas holiday, or Hanukkah, or Kwanzaa, or whatever holiday they decided to travel on sometime in late December or New Year's Eve. And they'll start dying in January, and some might get recorded in January, and others will be recorded in February. And then if indeed 8 or 9 of the top 10 are people that died in December, and that'll probably be replaced by 8 or 9 days that more died in January. And that'll be replaced by 8 or 9 examples of people that died in February, because each month that number is going to continue going up. Now, after February, the numbers might start leveling off and coming down because enough people have died that people really will stay home, or there won't be a holiday in early January to cause people to congregate, or by February there may be some diminution in cases because people got vaccinated in December and did not get infected, and therefore they did not go in the hospital, and therefore they did not go on a ventilator, and therefore they did not die, and therefore they didn't show up as a death in February or March. And so those numbers may start to come down. But unfortunately, apparently because of a shortage of proteinase K, of all things, the falling of those numbers may be delayed and may not really show up very dramatically until March or April numbers as far as deaths are concerned. And the numbers hopefully will start to go down as far as those that get infected, assuming that those that don't get infected because they were vaccinated are not overwhelmed by people that think that, well, there's a vaccine now. We can go back to normal life, or others that insisted this was all a hoax and saying, well, now they're trying to end the hoax, so they're saying the numbers are going down. And so there's really never been a problem, and now it's starting to disappear anyway. So more and more people will ignore the fact that the vaccine doesn't protect until you're vaccinated, and it doesn't really protect fully until about 6 weeks after you're vaccinated, because you need a second shot, and it takes several weeks for that to produce full immunity and full protection. So that's where we stand. The numbers I expect will be going up next week. We'll be doing regular updates to see what those numbers look like. There may be some clarification on what kind of shipment Pfizer is going to do, if it's really only going to be 6.2, and we'll probably get some type of clarification on where Moderna is, especially if they do get approved, that there'll be questions. You know, they'll already have a week's worth of data from Pfizer, and they'll say, well, are you going to do more than Pfizer? Because, is it going to be the same? Is it going to be less? And when is it going to get better? But right now, the virus is raging, the numbers are going up, and the delivery of vaccine is below expectations. That's it for now.
All right, thanks for the information. As always, please go to Recombinon and request the open layers of information, and we will be doing many more of these as the situation unfolds. Thanks for listening.